Welcome to episode 68 of Turkistan Europe, a podcast dedicated to discussing all things related to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. This podcast is a listener-supported podcast and our patrons donate to us via our Patreon page, for which we are extremely grateful. If you enjoy listening to Turkistan Europe and want even more, please support us at www.patreon.com/Turkistan Europe. Make sure to listen until the end of this episode for our traditional patron shoutout. My name is Maciek Makulski and with me is the other co-host of Turkistan Europe, Adam Reichardt. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Maciek. Welcome, listeners, and thank you for joining us. Each week, we bring you an in-depth discussion on a certain topic related to our region. This week, we are coming back to the Baltic states. As a reminder, the podcast is a member of the Europod Network, a network of European podcasts that covers various views on political and social trends in Europe and beyond.
Thanks, Adam. Well, listeners, let's get started on episode 68. So, hello again. I think this intro will keep quite short because we have a very special guest today. And as Adam said in the beginning, we are coming back in this episode to the Baltic states. We try to cover all political developments in all Baltic republics from time to time. Maybe it's not our most frequently covered topic at the Turkistan Europe, but today our guest is Linas Linkevičius, a Lithuanian politician and diplomat. He was the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Lithuania between 2012 and 2020. And Minister Linkevičius previously served as the ambassador to Belarus, permanent representative of Lithuania to NATO. And also he was the head of the Lithuanian mission to NATO from 1997 to 2000.
So, yes, a very, very impressive resume in terms of exactly. His diplomatic experience.
Yeah. Very experienced practitioner of politics, we can say. And actually we focused entirely to discuss international, I think we can say that, international affairs from the perspective of the Baltic Sea region. But we have touched upon relations with Russia, also in the context of the war in Eastern Ukraine, but also relations between the European Union and China. And I think he has very fresh, very valid points he really puts into the discussion. So I hope you will like the interview. But also, having said that, we want to underline that this interview is kind of overture or preludium of a bigger thing about the Baltic states prepared by the New Eastern Europe magazine. And maybe, Adam, I would like to ask you as the editor-in-chief to say a few words about this project.
Sure. So this is the interview today is kind of launching our special coverage that we will be having of the Baltic states in the next issue, which is our April-May issue of New Eastern Europe. We have a special section covering the Baltics. Should be available early April. This interview was actually in the issue as well. We recorded this as our opening interview, and we decided to also do it as a podcast. So I think that's if you want to read it, or for those of who are reading it and want to listen to it, there's that option. And we look at really the aim was to look at some stories and the situation currently in the Baltic states. So we have a few overview texts, which is looking at the general situation, but then we also go to the individual states as well, looking at different social issues, political issues as well. And I think it's quite an interesting block of text that we have, including photo stories from each of the capitals, Riga, Vilnius, and Tallinn, with short descriptions of the situation, how it looked like there during lockdowns this winter. So I think it's a very interesting indeed for you to all check out, and it will be available soon.
Great. So not only politics, but also some other topics or some other texts for about the Baltic Sea region, which is also very important to me personally. I spent over a year in Estonia, and I can really say that this is a very interesting part of Europe, and which, of course, deserves more attention from us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So maybe that's enough for the introduction, and now it's time for the interview. What do you think?
Sounds great.
Welcome to our guest, Linas Linkevičius, Lithuanian politician and diplomat. He served as Lithuania's defense minister in 1993 to 1996 and again from 2000 to 2004, and most recently served as the foreign minister between 2012 and 2020. Mr. Minister, welcome to Talk Eastern Europe.
Thanks a lot.
I would like to start by asking about your tenure as foreign minister, which took place over the last 8 years, and which means that you were directly involved in different international affairs which shaped the European political landscape. And from the perspective of the Central and Eastern Europe, one of such events was undoubtedly the annexation of Crimea and the outbreak of war in Eastern Ukraine. Would you define a Russian aggression on Ukraine as something that defined your 2 terms as a foreign minister?
Well, unfortunately, you're right. During all these 8 years, we experienced just worsening of the relations with Russia. Mm-hmm. It was not European guilt or the West was doing something wrong. It simply was Russia's choice to go ahead with the aggressive foreign policy. I would say with military foreign policy even, because the military arguments are used in foreign policy by annexing neighboring countries, occupying, and this started not yesterday, by the way. We all remember there were some, let's recall war in South Caucasus in 2008, mm-hmm. where I believe there were quite good reaction from the Western countries at that time. If you remember, there were statements made by European Union, by NATO, by whomever, and they were very clear demands, hopes, expectations, what Russia must do in order to come back to normal business. But literally nothing was done, let me remind. And we came back to business as usual in a couple of months, basically, because there were voices calling for pragmatism, for importance of economic relations, and a lot of challenges should be had kind of solved together. And there were many, many arguments used, and we retreated, basically. Mm. This is true. Despite of some voices, including my voice, by the way, and some others, yeah. which were quite minority by far, of course, yeah. in this discussion. And then it was a surprise why it's continuing, you know. It's guys, but we told you this is continuing. By the way, it's not just European Union. In 2008, we also had Bucharest NATO summit, and probably you remember there was also big discussion whether to give membership action plan to Georgia and Ukraine or mm-hmm. not. And there were voices saying that we cannot do that because it's provocative. It's provocative and we will create big crises. And we told that it will be provocative not to give the map because that would open gates for further intervention, for further kind of, exposure of power. And by the way, in August, the war started. So we were right. And I remember when we told to the opponents that, guys, we were right. You know, we told you that something will happen if we'll not do that. It will be kind of provocative gesture from our side. But they said, no, it could be worse. So that's the logic explains quite clearly where we kind of stand in terms of our positions and assessments. Yep. So 2008, okay? At that time, I told myself, I remember giving interviews to many papers that will be more conflicts. And I mentioned Crimea, by the way, also, which was not on the agenda at that time. But Crimea also happened. And there were surprises why it's happening. Now, aggression against Donbas. Let's mention that Russia potentially could be quite helpful and rational in solving crises around the globe, by influence and other means. But unfortunately, Russia being permanent member of UN Security Council creating problems. And it's not just in Europe. Recently, it was veto number 15, I believe, on Syria, right? So now we're talking not about Syria now, but just I'm saying that this is happening around the globe. And again, it shouldn't be surprising because policy of Russia is testing of resilience, testing of principled position, of tolerance, if you wish so, testing of patience of own people, what we have seen lately after the events with Navalny poisoning, and now another story emerging of poisoning of Karamurza journalist. Again, Bellingcat should be the study which Kremlin will have big problems again to deny something which is happening, and this is very unfortunate, although it's not surprising, but really disgusting. And, you know, I can mention and continue more and more. So all through all these 8 years, let me mention one more point, which is also very, very important. I remember during our presidency in the Council of European Union, its second part of 2013, we had also many discussions about Eastern Partnership in particular because of the summit which was approaching at that time. And we're discussing strategic communication. And I remember the very first discussion was very difficult to understand each other among us. I mean, Europeans, what we're talking about. And there were colleagues saying, guys, what kind of strategic communications are we going to introduce European censorship or European propaganda or something? But we said, no, we are talking about need to fight with fake news, which is becoming a weapon. And we try to convince our colleagues that freedom of speech has nothing to do with freedom to lie. If you're lying deliberately, that means you're brainwashing people and demotivating them. And that's why I'm saying this, because this, how many years ago, right? Many years ago, 7 years ago, it was very difficult to discuss because we were not understood. But later on, we established a special cell in the External Action Service for Strategic Communication. Now we are doing something. We're doing more than before, but it's not enough. Why I'm saying this is this also takes time to understand, takes time to realize that something is qualitatively different taking place. And we are lagging behind, very difficult to understand. And after this visit of Josep Borrell to Moscow was another kind of reality check. And for those who were still naively think that we are on good track of some kind of dialogue, it was understood that Russia is not ready, by far not ready to any dialogue.
Yeah.
And recently Lavrov stated that Russia ready to cut relations with the European Union. I immediately reacted that it's rather to be said that Russia is not ready to have normal relations. To cut, it's not a big deal because they do not have these relations. They cannot get rid of the zero-sum thinking. They cannot get rid of the policy of selective engagement with regard to the international law. They cannot abolish zero-sum thinking. This is the main story. So what I'm mentioning here, quite prolonged monologue, my point is that we are still in the searching of our strategy with Russia. We do not have the strategy. Mm. We cannot agree what we would like to have in the future. Do we really believe that it's possible to have partnership or cooperation, or it's just competition of geopolitical, I would say, competition, which is also not understood by many among us. When I'm saying about Eastern Partners, I'm saying that this is also geopolitical process. It's not technical. And Eastern Partnership Program, especially with regard to three association kind of process members, this is not just technical cooperation with European Union, but also geopolitical for them. And you will not understand that. This will be big fault. So a lot of kind of skepticism here I'm providing you, because I believe we are really not understanding sufficiently what's going on. And through all these years in office, I noticed just decline, unfortunately, in these relations. And I do not see any kind of light even now, you know, because there's no changes in the thinking, no changes even in the rhetoric. So that means we are doing something wrong and not enough. Or if we are doing something, it's usually too late or too little.
Well, I think we'll have a chance to talk about some specifics on the Eastern Partnership, especially Ukraine and Belarus, in a moment. But I wanted to ask about your reflections on the Baltic states, which we often see as one unit, as a whole. But in fact, they are three separate countries with their own languages, their own culture and history. But at the same time, they do face similar issues, similar threats, which you have already touched upon. And there are shared experiences as well. And in this year, we will commemorate the 30 years of the fall of the Soviet Union. So I'm curious as to what your thinking is when we look at the three countries. Is it fair to lump the Baltic states together as a block of countries that have similar interests and similar goals? Or would you prefer we look at them individually when we are discussing politics and geopolitics?
No, both. You know, I would say it's natural because when at the very beginning of our independence, we were all three together. I was defense minister at that time, and I remember we even didn't have bilateral relations. We had trilateral meetings, only trilateral. Mm. So we met trilaterally, defining our priorities, trying to understand what we have to do, and looking for donors, partners, those who are ready to assist. And then we launched, there's no time to elaborate more, but just to mention, we launched these famous projects as Baltic Battalion, or airspace control projects, Baltic Defense College still in Tartu, mm-hmm. now in chain of NATO, and so on and so forth. Air policing, right? Yeah. Airspace Coordination Center was established near Kaunas at that time in 94, 95, and now it's still used, but now it's used for different purposes. So we started in the very right way, I believe, tried to coordinate ourselves. As you rightly noticed, not the same country cannot be. Also, there are some national interests, but we have much more in common than different, to say in short. And after joining the EU, after joining NATO, it was not so important to have this trilateral because you're a member of a bigger family and meeting very often. But despite that fact, we also have very efficient formats of cooperation, which enriches our activity in other international organizations. I have in mind Nordic Baltic, for instance. Mm-hmm. And the beginning, it was also very interesting. It was called, if you remember, 5+3, 5 Nordic, 3 Baltic. And now it's Nordic Baltic 8. So even a title explains a lot because it's becoming more integration, not just cooperation. And I'm really proud and happy that this is not only on the strategic level, like, so to say, economy and healthcare or whatever, but also on grassroots level, municipalities. Mm-hmm. And this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I would say this format NB8, it's like a bridge between European Union and NATO, because some countries are members of both organizations, some are members of just one. And we are talking not to distance or to kind of fragment what we're doing, but trying to bridge. And really what we're developing, the initiatives are, I believe, enriching our overall activity, be it NATO or European mm-hmm. Union. So Baltic states also part of that game, and this is continuous. So that's true. But also one more aspect I'd like to, which is not surprisingly strange for you, we were part of former Soviet Union.
Right.
Forcibly included, but nevertheless, it was the fact. De facto, and we knew I still can understand much better Moldavians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Georgians, much better than others, to say in short, right? And even we can speak with them Russian, which is also important. Some of them, not now new generation, it's not a problem for mm-hmm. them, but for some it is a problem, and mentality problem, cultural interaction always is a problem. So I believe this is also gives us a chance and opportunity to be more efficient,
yeah.
And in explaining what we did, how we went through this process. It was relatively fresh, by the way. Memory is still here, and again, here three Baltic states really can be more instrumental than others. Therefore, we need to coordinate more among ourselves. But we are proud and happy that we can also have on board other like-minded people and countries like those who were in the cradle of Eastern Partnership, like Sweden and Poland, let me remind, or Romania, Bulgaria, to some extent Czech Republic, but unfortunately not too many enthusiasts here. We need much more.
Yeah. Well, that actually leads me to my next question, which is looking at how the Baltic states play a strong leadership role on Eastern policy within the European Union. especially in recent years since Crimea and Ukraine and the war in Donbass, but also now with Belarus. And we see Vilnius being a host to many of those fleeing Lukashenko's repressions. You have mentioned this already, but I'm curious why you think countries like Lithuania and other Baltic states, including Poland, are leaders in supporting those who are fighting for freedom in the post-Soviet space. Does it have to do with geography, shared history, or is it also a feeling that you might have gone through it and now is an opportunity to help those who are fighting for their freedom?
Yeah, you answered yourself. Maybe many reasons, but one of the main reasons is definitely shared history and these memories, which are still fresh. And I would add, again, from my own experience, one point I'm always mentioning to Georgians and Ukrainians about the ambitions of integration. You know, when we were told at that time, I was also ambassador to NATO, you know, it was up before 2000. And I remember I was told by future allies many times that your country is small, beautiful, your freedom fight is very impressive, but you will never be a member of NATO. Hmm. And it was told me, really not once, by future allies by 2000. Look at the geography, look at the map, you know, there are interests and so on and so forth. So that was kind of motivation for us. And this is really recently, you know, 2000, it's really recently. So we remember what that means when you are kind of deserted, you know, and you are alone and nobody ready to help. So maybe that also explains why our people are not indifferent when something happening in the neighborhood. And you remember probably this Freedom Way, which was organized from Vilnius to the border of Belarus, where I was standing, not as a minister at that time. I was just as a citizen because it was organized by NGOs. It was not organized by government. And people came with the white and red colors and with the flowers, with the children. And again, the question, why it was not in other capitals? It was, but not to such extent. So this explains that emotionally people are feeling associated. And this is not just empathy or support, but also kind of feeling of duty that we have to stand, we have to help. And that's also the reason why they are coming here in Lithuania and feeling them comfortably, because we are trying to get away from this repressions, but on the other hand, almost all of them, they believe that they will be back because they're not leaving their country forever. So Vilnius is not so far from Minsk, as we all know. And now I'm sitting very close to the border, so it's really very close. So they're not far away from the home, but they are far away from this danger, which is not diminishing, by the way, unfortunately. And again, let me add, I'm really quite kind of disappointed that our reaction is not sufficient again here. Of course, we cannot be blamed that for what's happening because we are not doing that, but we really can be more instrumental to keep pressure, to be more consistent, not only on Belarus or outgoing leader who still hesitates whether to go or not, but with regard to the sponsors in Kremlin, the only supporters who are also responsible for these developments. And all in all, we see the situation when we the European Union, almost half of the billion population, major player in the world by means of economy, and we cannot be key players in managing conflicts even in our continent. So this is I'm not talking far away, which is also a good question, but let's look here. This is Europe. This is our continent. And a lot of questions raised. Again, who will talk about that if not us? If we even feeling that we are sometimes in minority, I believe we have to do that.
And as you said a few times already, not enough is being done in relations with Russia or regarding the situation in Belarus. I would like also to ask about that, because you were critical about the EU response to the situation in Belarus during the protests. I would like to ask, what do you think more could be done right now? And what should the EU do after 6 months since the outbreak of protests in Belarus?
From the outset, I have to say that, first of all, we all understand, I hope, that we cannot intervene or intervene, so to say, it's not our task, right? We cannot do something for them. Be it Russia or Belarus, only those people will define their future themselves. But our task to take sides sometimes, you know, not to be impartial observer. And I mean, to support civil society meaningfully, and what we are doing in Lithuania and Poland doing, and now, and some others should do as well, supporting civil society, well, suggesting this refuge for those who need this protection, and to find ways how to support in financially also those victims of repressions. I believe we really should take a lead in international judicial process, which was, by the way, suggested and advised by European Parliament. In European Parliament, there were good resolutions passed, not the only one I'm now quoting, which would be useful to apply. But this is also said that we have to start international investigation on possibly crimes committed. And somebody should take the lead here. Sanctions is least we can do. We cannot solve problems by sanctions, but even sanctions are not sufficient. Let me remind, after 2010, and you probably remember, there were also a list of sanctions, 133, I believe, on the list, including Lukashenko at the very beginning. And was not a problem, but now the list is much shorter, let me say, although brutality was much bigger. And it took time until we put Lukashenko on the list, because there were calls that we shouldn't do that for whatever reason. When I'm asked sometimes by journalists that, look, sanctions not working, be it Crimea, be it whatever, not working, so why are we doing that? This is detrimental also for our economy, so let's stop. Stop doing these sanctions. I'm saying, if it's not working, let's add sanctions, because they're not... On Russia, it's 150 or something on the list also. Not terribly big number. And that means we are not using instruments we have. In European Union, we adopted a lot of possibilities to use sanctions against cyber threats, about chemical weapons, about repressions, whatever. We even adopted this human rights pact, which I believe very important, as we are calling since 2017 Magnitsky Act in Lithuania. And this is not used sufficiently. So let's use it. Let's use it. Also, let's use isolation. I'm not saying to cut ties. It's not about that. But let's avoid this kind of demonstrative visits, which leads nowhere, and even sometimes detrimental, because these contacts are serving as smoke screen for our colleagues and neighbors to continue with the politics as they did, but trying to create impression that this is business as usual. The cooperation is going on, you know, we are talking, we are disagreeing on something, but we are ready to talk on where we can agree. And this is like really business as usual, which is very detrimental in my view. So in short, what we can do, we are not doing. And this is very simple advice. So easy to say, a lot of voices objecting what I'm saying. I do not believe that we could find consensus to act, but maybe after such a stress test as visit to Moscow by Borrell, maybe that will help for him to understand, for others, that we have to do something. It's interesting. But after Lavrov's statement that he is ready to cut ties if Europe will come up with the sanctions, something like that. So maybe that, again, I said, another test for Kremlin believers. They again testing how much they can do without any consequences. And this is up to us to make a choice. So mm-hmm. we will see. Remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on Belarus, I'm curious as to your opinion. Do you think it is a matter of time for Lukashenko that he will eventually go?
No, it was always the case. You know, he 26 years in power, and for 20 years the implementing so-called Union of Two States agreement, right? Let me remind, with Russia. And it could be interesting question, why so long? When I was in Minsk last year, I also asked, I remember, why it's so long? They said, look, there is a beginning for integration, but it's not the end. So this is kind of an everlasting process. So, okay, but nevertheless, this is the process where Russia wants to digest that country by all means. And I'm afraid after Lukashenko did to his own people, to his own country for the one purpose, just to stay in power, he made such a big damage to the remainings of sovereignty and independence. And now Russia will use all chance definitely to make all kind of will use all these opportunities to accomplish as much as possible. I would predict that de facto, no, rather de jure, Belarus will remain independent country, will have foreign ministry and, you know, seat in UN Security Council, not Security Council, but United Nations. Same, by the way, that it was during Soviet times, if you remember. They were also seats by Ukraine, by Belarus. So it's fine, de jure, but de facto it will be totally dependent as it was before, even more. So this is the consequences, and that's we have to understand. But again, the main sponsor is in Kremlin, the main supporters in Moscow, and that means that for them Lukashenko is also not needed for long. It's very too toxic. So I don't think that he will remain too long. Now to remove him today, that means show this weakness that now they are following these calls of so-called Democrats and whatever the West. So we cannot do that, but they will do that later. And Lukashenko is also believe that he's not needed anymore. So now we should think about the future. What will happen after these changes? Now the doing this artificial changes and changing constitution, although it's not the biggest task today in Belarus. The constitution maybe could be better, but this is really not something that should be solved tonight. It's more problems. They should have new normal elections. That's a problem. And here will be the enormous efforts to make sure that as the result of these elections will come these pro-Kremlin forces in Belarus, and that will be done very seriously. Right. I have no doubt it's already process is in preparation. Again, our voice, what we will do, will not do for them, but again, with whom we will be talking, with whom we will be supporting. Mm-hmm. Our measures sufficiently efficient, sanctions, isolation, whatever. This is the question. And if we we'll look passively at what is happening, I'm afraid we will lose another geopolitical game and we'll lose influence in the parts of Europe, which could be really developed in different way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is the question. And it's this question is not answered.
Mm. Okay, so far we have been talking a lot about Russia, which is understandable, of course, but I would like to ask about another big challenge for the perspective of Europe. This is China and its growing ambition to play a greater role in different parts of the world, including Central and Eastern Europe, which is included in the Belt and Road Initiative led by China. And looking at this problem from the perspective of US-China competition, developing deeper relations with China also has a geopolitical dimension. And recently, the 17+1 summit took place with Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, not represented by their highest representatives, while China was represented by President Xi Jinping. This might suggest that the Baltic states are keeping a distance in their relations with China. So I would like to ask you, how does Lithuania build its relations with China? And maybe to put it in a broader context, what approach for the EU would be effective in your opinion?
We're always looking for the ways how to get to the dialogue with such a super big country. And for small countries, it's difficult. So why this format was emerged, 17+1. So it explains a lot. On the other hand, our policies and experience are national specific. In short, I would say, because not much time, when talking about China, right. let me draw attention that China is a challenge not only for European Union, but also for United States, maybe one of the major challenges, but also for Russia. Mm-hmm. China is really, really a big player with the expanding ambitions, economic security, whatever means, growing economy. And this is becoming the issue. So the countries where they have very close and deep and wide economic relations, it's one story that explains why we sometimes cannot agree on common policies. Mm-hmm. Because some countries mm-hmm. are, you know, more engaged and they are reluctant mm-hmm. to react more drastically on some violations of human rights, for instance, yeah. right, mm-hmm. or some other issues. and we cannot agree. But with regard to the economy, we really can do a lot of things. And Lithuania, we have experience. We have even law, which is for supervising and kind of controlling of investments into strategic sectors. And there are red lines, so we cannot allow for doing this in the strategic sectors like transport, infrastructure, or to be more precise, in port.
Mm-hmm.
So the short answer would be, and recipe, to set rules and stick to the rules. Because, you know, this country is really quite ambitious, but also quite sensitive with regard to the relationship, and they should, they are seeking equal treatment, so. To say, and we are saying that, guys, there are rules, so we cannot allow you to get closer into the strategic sectors, which is not allowed by our law, and regardless is it China or whatever other country, and this is working. With the politics also, we applied the so-called One China policy with all consequences, but it doesn't mean that we cannot have relations with Taiwan, for instance, cultural, economic. And that was also big noise, if you remember, when, you know, inviting or not Taiwan to the World Health Organization event after first wave of pandemic. And we were also quite outspoken in saying that we have to do that because it's not the politics. It's just their very good achievements, experience, and could be really useful for all to listen. That was very, very, very sensitive reaction by China at that time, I can tell you. But we explained that we did nothing wrong. We didn't violate anything. And we are going to continue. We will not give up. So it's also testing how much they can demand. So in short, I believe there should be rules and sticking to the rules. So this is the way to go. Other ways I cannot understand. And we should really understand that this ambitions expansion is very, very, really, really big and could be bigger if will not be kind of, if this resilience will not be sufficient. Therefore, we need to coordinate our policies with other like-minded people, or I would say allies, the United States, which not everyone in Europe agrees, but I believe this is wrong. We have to coordinate, especially after Biden administration came in, and this is not done before. So this is also should be developed, and we can be stronger in coordinating our efforts and mitigating all these threats which could emerge because of these ambitions. And, but that's it.
Yeah. If I could briefly follow up on that, I wanted to ask also about your opinion on the Three Seas Initiative. Is this something that could be seen as an alternative to Chinese projects? How is it from your perspective?
You know, at the beginning, we were maybe more observant, but now we are on board and also with the contribution. And so we are fully on board. We believe it's very valuable that also United States are part of this picture and Germany. This is important. If it will be a practical application, if it will really have additional backup for our infrastructure projects, if it will not be illusion that if we're doing that through the CC's initiative, then European Commission will be, let's say, less reluctant, right, to come up with the projects which are important for us, that would be wrong. But if it's supplementary, if it's an addition, again, very practical application, I believe this is really a good way to go. So therefore, we are on board, and I hope we will looking forward how to be developed. So it could be another leverage.
You have already mentioned the new Biden administration, and we would like to know your take on the new administration. We all know that this administration will be emphasizing rebuilding alliances, especially the transatlantic alliance. So what does this mean from the Baltics perspective?
Well, first of all, would be nice to preserve what was done in a positive way. Let's be clear, and let's not only follow statements, tweets, but also what's happening on the ground. Right, we're saying, and difficult to deny that engagement with United States, national engagement in our region, Baltic, Polish region, let me say, was really very substantial, visible, and we would like to preserve. But this shouldn't be done at the expense of European engagement, and this is also the case. So my Biden administration will improve, I believe, this track, and which was really quite too big, I would say. And back on track is always better because European Union is not the enemy for United States. And this is quite clearly stated. So we have to come back, same as it was on climate issues, for instance, same as it is. And it will be not so easy, but also we have to do our efforts and improve our trade cooperation. will not come back to this TTIP, you know, probably era, but nevertheless, to come back more than it was before, it's also our task. And not only security, so by other means. We have really to coordinate our records and coordinate our menu, what we're going to do, as it should be, as it was not done before, but preserving what was done in the right way I just mentioned. So this is in short, and again, coming back to China, I believe also we have to coordinate strategies on Russia, on China. That will be our strength. If we'll not do that, it will be really, really quite detrimental and not responsible, simply.
Well, Mr. Minister, thank you so much for taking your time.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for joining us at Talk Eastern Europe.
Take care. Have a nice day.
And that was our interview with Linas Linkevičius, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Republic of Lithuania. He served between 2012 and 2020. You can also look forward to this interview in print in the paper edition of the next issue of New Eastern Europe, which has a broader coverage of Baltic Sea region. Maciek, I thought it was very interesting not only to hear about you know, the situation in the region, but also his reflections on a lot of the important issues and his experience. And I think really it was interesting to hear, you know, some of his perspective of being, he's been probably one of the longest serving ministers of foreign affairs in the region. So he's been dealing with a lot of the issues that, you know, that have been facing this region for almost 10 years, almost the same amount of time as New Eastern Europe has been around as a magazine. So it was really good to hear his perspective. And of course, looking to the future, some of the challenges that still remain are serious and remain to keep an eye on for sure.
Absolutely. I think this conversation fits also to the broader topic of some kind of differences between the perspective on the relations between the EU and Russia that exist actually between Central Europe or Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And he also discussed it, but as we could hear, it didn't start yesterday or in the beginning of this year with the visit, Borrell's visit in Moscow, but there are issues that are with us for a long time, and this discussion is of course far from the end.
Just to one more point that I would add is that to have, you know, there are these debates within Europe about what should the engagement with Russia be like, how should it look like. I think the Baltic voice, you know, and the voice of Central Europeans are critical in this debate, and sometimes they are overlooked or not heard, because especially since there are a lot of smaller countries and maybe less, you know, haven't been members of the European Union as long. But I think that they are the ones who are the neighbors. You know, they are on the front lines of relations with Russia, so their voices are definitely critical in this debate.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, that they are great advocates of it, and they try to, you know, to remember about that, you know, there are other states than big players on the map. So I think that's very important, and I'm glad we had occasion to speak with Linas Linkevičius. I am also interested what can be his next role in politics, whether it will be in Lithuanian politics or maybe in the international organizations or international politics. He's still a young politician, yeah. So I think
that's true.
It would be good to use his expertise.
Yeah, it was really great to for us to to meet him and have that discussion. This was actually the second time, Maciek, you and I interviewed him. We did a short interview I don't remember, what was it, maybe 2015 or 2016 at the Riga conference in Riga. But it was unfortunately, it was very short and a little chaotic. And this was an opportunity for us to sit down and have a longer conversation with him.
It was 2016, and it was also interesting period in his career, because it was also after the election in parliamentary election in Lithuania, and back then wasn't 100% sure whether he will be or not a foreign minister for the next 4 years. So finally, it occurred he was. So it's quite maybe funny that we meet him in such periods of his political career.
Well, so thanks to our listeners for listening to that. I also would, you know, invite you all to share some of your feedback on the interview and just what you think about issues in general. We have a great Facebook page where you can interact with us and interact with other podcast listeners. It's facebook.com/groups/talkeastern-europe. It's kind of our way of interacting with our listeners. So Maciek, I think with that we can move into our announcements time of the podcast.
Yeah, and actually we have quite interesting announcement. We were surprised on Friday, March 20, I don't know, or maybe 19 or so.
19.
But it was a very nice surprise, because our podcast was named on the list of 50 greatest podcasts of the New European Online Journal. Correct me if I'm wrong with the name of the journal, Adam.
That's correct. Yep.
But it was really nice surprise, and this is also a great occasion to say thank you to all our patrons, guest speakers, and supporters and listeners, because it wasn't be possible without you. Because I think we all have a feeling that this podcast is kind of a collective project.
Yes, absolutely. And and we should especially thank our patrons who help financially support the podcast, Talk Eastern Europe. And if you're out there listening and you're not a patron, you can still join us. You know, we are at 32 right now, slightly over our goals. And we're looking at what our next goal should be for the patrons. And we do a lot of extra events and exclusive activities, some behind the scenes discussions with our patrons. So there's a lot of additional benefits for supporting us beyond just our traditional shout out, which we will do in a moment. But yeah, it was great to see us on this list, 50 greatest podcasts. I think that's something we can put on, you know, put on our description of the podcast for a while. I think it's a great achievement for us, and we definitely could not have done it without our supporters, as well as our listeners, and of course our patrons.
Yeah, and actually, Adam, 32 patrons, it's a nice bunch of people, I would say. And this is nice also experience, as you mentioned, from time to time we organize some special meetings for our patrons where we invite also special guests to discuss some topics. And it is nice, because for some patrons we already met few times, so we are we now know each other now better.
Yeah.
And this is also kind of exchanging of, you know, perceptions, exchanging of knowledge between simply people who are interested in knowing the region better.
Yeah, I'm connected to some of our patrons after these meetings and by email or social media, and, you know, some questions about certain issues, and it's great. So this is really like we're trying to build a community of people who are interested in what's happening here, because this region really is fascinating and a lot is happening. So I just want to, maybe I'll say hello to our patrons, because this is the most important part beyond the content of it, but thank you to our patrons, including Pierre, Stephanie, Mark, Jason, Janos, Eric, Elizabeth, David, Wilhelm, Scapegoast, Sophia, Ian, Urs, Pavel, William, Anastasia, David, Sean, Elise, JP, Sylvia, Naomi, Sean, Plumman, Klaus, Pat, CB, Marina, Lorenzo, Jane, Anastasia, and Ian. Thank you very much for your support, and we do look forward to additional events and engaging with you further.
Yes, and I think this is a perfect moment to say goodbye for this episode. I think that's all what we have for you. Thank you for listening, and until next time.